why Comey was so wrong about encryption, which was yesterday's topic, are very relevant to today's Crypto Wars update. So bear with us if we're repetitive, but we will cover a little bit more ground because I think yesterday was very much focused on some of the domestic issues, and now we are going to go to U.S., Europe, and beyond. So my name is Kurt Opsahl. I'm the Deputy Executive Director and General Counsel with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. EFF is a nonprofit civil liberties organization dedicated to defending your rights online. And my organization was a participant in Crypto Wars Part 1, or as we called it then, Crypto Wars, because now we are in Crypto Wars Part 2. In the 90s, there were a lot of attempts to make it more difficult to have everyday people have access to strong encryption. And encryption has been around for thousands of years. And as it's gotten broken, new crypto systems have come out. Oftentimes, it was a military technology. Though in the last 100 years or so, it started to become also a commercial technology. And in the last maybe 20-30 years, it started to become a bit more widespread and growing as such. So in the 90s, there was an attempt to regulate the flow of encryption. One of the effects was that for a while there was domestic and international versions of software. So Netscape Navigator, the first sort of very popular web browser, they realized that Netscape realized that for e-commerce to be successful, they wanted to have encryption so people could give their credit cards online, and so they invented a standard for this. But due to export controls, they couldn't export strong encryption, or it was strong at least in those days. And so the international version of Netscape Navigator had weak encryption, so it would be easy for intelligence services to crack it. And this was in part because encryption was characterized as a munition, and so subject to sort of some of the similar controls to, like, if you wanted to export a tank. These are very different things. And that turned out to not work. My organization had a lawsuit, US v. Bernstein. We were defending a researcher, Daniel Bernstein, who created a encryption program called Snuffle. It was open source. He was publishing it online, and we challenged the export controls on the basis of the First Amendment, that code is speech, and that the export controls couldn't regulate his ability to post some code online, even if it could provide strong encryption. And so that was established, that code is speech, and that helped, they dropped the encryption export controls that had been barring this strong version of encryption. Similarly, there was the Clipper chip. This was a chip that had a key escrow associated with it so that it would provide encryption, but also there was a copy of the key that the government could easily get if they could show that they needed it, and so that your encrypted communications could be readily decrypted should the government want to. There were a number of problems with that that program. Eventually, the Clipper chip was decided to be a bad idea, and we have some experts on that here on the panel. Fast forward a bit towards the last 5 or 10 years, there has been a resurgence in the government arguing that our governments, actually around the world, arguing that they are going dark, that the prominence of encryption has made their investigatory efforts too difficult, and that they want to have easier access to encrypted information. And this has manifested itself in a number of ways. You domestically, one of the more famous cases was the Apple iPhone controversy, where the government attempted to get a court order to require Apple to access the iPhone that had been used by one of the San Bernardino attackers. In addition, following that, there was some legislation. It was called the Compliance with Court Orders Act, which is set within the U.S. government framing that they are just asking for compliance with court orders. Who could be upset by that? But nevertheless, many people were upset with that, in part because there's a lot of worries that you can't successfully do this, that if there is a system that allows for a backdoor into encryption, that that backdoor will not be properly secured, other people can get into it, this will end up weakening the standards, and that this is not properly weighing the value of encryption to keep people safe and overvaluing the desire to allow for government access on demand. And then at the same time, encryption has been a increasingly important topic all around the world. Recently, the last couple of years, WhatsApp went to an encrypted protocol, and with one move, a billion people or more were getting end-to-end encrypted communications. And this has upset a number of countries. It's come up most frequently in Brazil, where from time to time they will arrest a Facebook employee, because Facebook owns WhatsApp, and put him in jail overnight because Facebook is unable to provide the content of communications. Usually the employee is let out the next day, but this is a way of Brazil expressing its displeasure at not being able to get the WhatsApp communications. So there have been pieces of legislation introduced and in some cases passed that have been demanding backdoor access to encrypted communications. So the question that was presented in our panel description is, what happens if governments get everything they're asking for, and how can our digital lives be defended? So now I'll turn it over to the rest of my panelists to introduce themselves and give their take on that question.
Hello, everyone. My name is Blair Chintella. I've been here at DragonCon speaking on these types of issues for about 5 or 6 years now. If you've been here before, we've had good panels on, you know, the Edward Snowden disclosures, net neutrality, and a bunch of other topics. My personal opinion on that issue is that we need more encryption, because if we don't have the encryption we need to communicate securely, then it undermines anyone can access all the communications. So it's sort of a double-edged sword, to where if we don't have the encryption, then like we can't communicate. How do I put this? Where basically we want secure communications, but we also want the government to be able to access our records if they have a search warrant. But if there's a vulnerability that the government isn't telling us about, which has been found out to be true, then anyone can exploit that vulnerability. So it's come out in the news that the government is basically hoarding these so-called zero days and not informing tech companies of them. And as a result, people who are more sophisticated can have access to them. But for everyday people's usage, they just go on believing that you know, the programs are secure. I think it was recently the government even asked a group of hackers to hack its website, and everybody basically got a free pass about, you know, hacking the government website, and they found like 167 vulnerabilities just from hacking that website. So I think those types of things are, our government needs to encourage more of that. And there is a real threat, I think, from having too much encryption to a certain extent when you look at it in isolation. However, I think that
encrypt all the things.
Right. I think the federal government tends to, you know, the going dark problem is just a false argument. There are a lot of different other investigative techniques that you don't hear about when the government comes forward and says we're going dark because of this encryption. Yes, maybe they cannot see this one particular iPhone, but there are a plethora of other ways, traditional investigative techniques that the government can use to get the same information. And again, my opinion, they're just kind of, they want the backdoor key because it's a lot easier. So from a civil liberties perspective, you know, we don't want to, it's not supposed to be easy for the government to just access all our communications. There's supposed to be significant hurdles. And so an often frequently used example is, should there ever be a box that is impossible to unlock? And I would say to that simple hypothetical, yes. You know, I can write down something, I can burn the piece of paper. That doesn't mean we're going to outlaw paper, to counter with another very simple example. So overall, I see the costs and benefits of either way, but more encryption for the public, I think, is the right way to go. Thank you.
I'm Matt Blaze. I'm a computer science professor at the University of Pennsylvania. I've been working in encryption and computer security and large-scale systems since the early 90s. Can you hear me now? Okay. So I've been working on this since the early 1990s, and was, you know, one of on the battlefield for Crypto War One, when the government first proposed something called the Clipper chip, I happened to work for the company that was manufacturing the first device that would use the Clipper chip. AT&T, which made a secure phone that included this key escrow feature. It was very controversial. I learned about it when the New York Times published an article. But I ended up getting a couple of samples of the Clipper chip and discovering some technical flaws with them that would allow you to bypass the government access capability and use it without being subject to key escrow, and that kind of killed the Clipper chip proposal. But we spent the entire 1990s kind of arguing about whether we should have encryption instead of actually making our infrastructure secure. Eventually, the government relented and said, basically, go ahead and do all the crypto that you want. And in fact, legally, that's kind of still the current situation. Now, what's interesting about this is that when the Clipper chip came out in 1992, when it was first described, 1993, the first product was actually shipped that included it, the government made this very strong argument, very dire argument, that basically said, if wiretaps see lots of encryption on it, you know, law enforcement and national security intelligence gathering is going to completely shut down, and you know, there will just be chaos and anarchy will reign, and we will not be able to solve crimes ever again. And if you look at this, you know, essentially everything that the government asked for, they didn't get, and none of those things actually happened. Right, you know, criminal prosecutions continue to happen to this day. Intelligence gathering agencies continue to be able to do their work. Well, why is that? Why didn't this horrible crisis happen? And the reason is, as you suggested, investigators and people gathering intelligence have lots of options. One of them is wiretapping out of the infrastructure. But there are others, like going after the endpoints themselves, where the encryption keys, if it is encrypted, are located, that are also viable techniques. Another viable technique is the use of confidential informants and other kinds of records and artifacts. In fact, you know, wiretapping off of the communications network is just kind of a tiny corner of the ways criminal evidence and intelligence get gathered. So why is encryption so important? Well, the reason is that we have, since the Clipper chip was proposed at the beginning of Crypto War One, we are in what I think everyone would agree is a cybersecurity crisis, right? We have data breaches literally every day, and it's only when they're on an incredibly huge scale that they even make the news. And the reason for that is my particular branch of computer science, computer security, is like completely incompetent. We don't know how to build secure large-scale systems. You know, we're trying. I like to think it's not because the people working in my field are dumber than the people doing like graphics and processors and all sorts of great stuff. But we seem to be making negative progress. Every year, systems become worse. We have more data breaches, more exposure, more vulnerability. And the reason for that is we simply don't know how to build secure, reliable software systems. One of the only tools in our arsenal, and it doesn't solve every problem, but one of the only tools in our arsenal is encryption. That lets us essentially reduce the size of the system that we have to actually protect and make secure. If you have end-to-end encrypted communication, you only have to trust the software on the endpoints. You don't have to trust the network itself. And that just simplifies the security problem in ways that give us some hope of managing it. By discouraging the use of encryption, by making it more expensive, by making it more complicated, by regulating it, the government is essentially taking away one of the only tools we have to secure what really amounts to a national infrastructure that we're using for incredibly serious stuff. The international dimension of this just makes this even harder. Virtually everything we use has a supply chain that leads back to Asia somewhere. If the Chinese government decides to mandate, we need a copy of every encryption key, those products are sold in the United States. Does the United States really want to use products that the Chinese government has access to? And so on. So the international dimension of this just makes this problem even more urgent, and the kind of proposed solution, put back doors in encryption that the government can use, more and more ludicrous. So
I'm Amy Stepanovich. I am U.S. Policy Manager and Global Policy Counsel for Access Now, and one of the reasons I had that second title is because of the work I do on encryption. So I actually think the setup for the encryption panels was showed really astute thinking, because where the U.S. debate is like encryption policy 101, the global debate is 201. And by the time I finish what I hope are very brief opening remarks, I will show the ones of you, the people who were in the panel yesterday, why a lot of that conversation was like totally irrelevant at this point. So the U.S. is the place where we have fought about encryption for the longest period of time. And I actually think Kurt, in his opening remarks, was being a little bit kind, because I'm not sure if we're not on Crypto Wars 4 or 5 by now. I think 2 might be too low of a number at this point, but I get it. Back maybe 2 or 3 years ago, when this fight started coming up in the U.S. again, we warned people then under the Obama administration that the U.S. government's arguments on this would be used by other countries to provide political cover to get the same type of access the U.S. was discussing at that point. There were no active proposals just yet. And they kind of laughed at us. They were like, no, that will never happen. The funny thing is it did happen. In Kazakhstan already, they mandate all users to have what they call national security certificates installed on their devices, which are very traditional backdoors and give the government access to the data on those devices. China has said that companies, by law now, have to comply with requests for information, and the penalty for a serious non-compliance with that law, there's no maximum dollar amount set for those penalties. So they could basically bankrupt a company out of existence if they don't comply. To my knowledge, that provision has never actually been invoked, but it could be. It's on the books. It's law in China. Brazil is pushing very, very hard, and they're challenging WhatsApp in court for not having provided information. Where else are we seeing this? It's all over the place. And it's getting more serious. And in fact, it got really serious, I think, at the end of last year and coming into this year, because the Five Eyes are now involved. The Five Eyes are a global intelligence partnership of the US, the UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. It's the most powerful intelligence partnership in the world. And when the United Kingdom passed their Investigatory Powers Act, it included a provision basically on backdoors. But they did it really, really sneakily. Because they didn't say all companies install backdoors on, in your software. They said, we can come to you, company, and we can tell you that you have to do something. And as long as you don't challenge it or we can overcome your challenge to it, you have to do that thing. So the backdoors aren't written into law, so you couldn't, when the law was being passed, argue that they were passing a backdoor law because it doesn't say that. You'll also likely never know when that law is being invoked because there's not really good transparency. And instead, what you're going to get is one day you're going to have an app on your phone that says, the company who built this app would like to install an update. And it's really good to update your apps. It's a good security practice, and you will update that app, and it will contain a backdoor from the UK government that they mandated be put into that application. And so that is that passed. That is in law. They are currently trying to implement that, so it's not necessarily enforced just yet, even though it's in law. In the meantime, Australia, down, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere, I was just there. It's really far away. It's a 15-hour plane ride. I lived every hour of that twice. They said, well, wait a second. The U.S. is talking about this, and the U.K. is talking about this. We want that. We want that. The laws of math don't work here. The laws of Australia overrule the laws of math. And they're fighting really hard, and they're taking it to the Five Eyes as a whole and saying, why don't we work together? So it's really getting serious because once the Five Eyes implement these things, everybody else is going to follow. That's going to be the end of the story. Now, a couple things that I think are really important to mention here. The first is, if you've heard me as I've been talking, there has not been one uniform approach to backdoors. You heard one approach in China, one approach in Kazakhstan, one approach in Brazil, etc. Which means any company that operates globally, which means any company on the internet, because the internet is global, has to comply with all of these different laws, which means they're not building in one backdoor, they're building in 10 backdoors for 10 different governments who implement them 10 different ways. Maybe big, rich companies can afford to implement one product in China that has only China's backdoor and one in the US. They're not going to stay only in China and the US, as Matt said, they will spread, but maybe they can do 10 different products. Small companies that don't have that sort of capital can't do that. They won't be able to afford it. So they will have one product that's just incredibly, incredibly insecure. So not only are you going to have a big security crisis, you're going to have a competition crisis because those little companies aren't going to be able to keep up with their very insecure products. Why is yesterday's conversation irrelevant? So I said the UK has passed a backdoor law. I've said the US and the UK have a very close partnership. What do you think the US is going to do if they don't have a backdoor law and they want a company to insert a backdoor? They're going to be able to get that information from the UK. I honestly think the moment that the Investigatory Powers Act passed in the US, even though the US had nothing to do with it, we lost the crypto wars. And I think that there can be very serious consequences of that. Luckily, we have one last opportunity. We have one last Obi-Wan Kenobi out there in the ether. And that's the fact that there is this agreement being negotiated right now between the US and the UK. I'm about to get a little bit wonky, and I know you're thinking she's about to get a little bit wonky. So basically, the UK wants the ability to go to companies in the United States directly and say, give us your data, or to get on the wire and wiretap directly in the US. They can't do that right now. They have to go through a super, super well-known process called the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, or MLAT process, if they want to get data that's held in the US by US companies. They are negotiating a agreement with the US to be able to bypass that process and go directly to the companies. The US could, as a precondition of that agreement, which the UK wants bad, say you need better human rights protections, including better protections for security in your law, and you need to amend this law that you just passed. It's something that we've been pushing the US government to do, if they really care about security, is to use this agreement as a lever to get that. But I think having that agreement out there has been very important, and it's part of this overall international context that these conversations are happening in. And I'll stop with this one point about context, because it's really, really important. a lot of the times when backdoors are put into law, it's not about encryption or about security necessarily, because all of those governments will stand up and freely admit they care about cybersecurity. I think it's the U.S.'s number one priority is cybersecurity for years now. They want more security. The FBI will encourage you to use encryption. Other governments will also say, no, we want you to use encryption. It's very rarely about security. It's about different things in different places. So for Kazakhstan, it's about censorship and about making sure that they know they can get access to any dissidents and make sure nobody's speaking out against the government. In Australia, it's actually about bypassing this MLAT system, the same as it might be in the UK. They think that if they can get backdoors to information, they will no longer have to go through this process. So they're talking about crypto backdoors as a way to get access to international data for their law enforcement. In Brazil, it's a very interesting context because Facebook, because of the MLAT process, has not willingly turned over a lot of data to Brazilian police and investigations because they insist on the Brazilian police going through this process. So Brazil feels like Facebook does not respect Brazilian law. In a lot of ways, Facebook is in a bad position because they cannot actually respect Brazilian law and U.S. law at the same time. There's a conflict of laws there, and they're in a bad position. But the Brazilian government feels like Facebook has not respected them. So when they came up against WhatsApp, even though it is not possible for that information to be turned over because it was encrypted and they don't have it, they are using this to throw the book at Facebook in a lot of ways and to say, no, you don't respect us. If you don't give us this data, that's it. So it's really fascinating to look at what political motivations are behind these requests for backdoors, because it's very rarely about security, but it's going to have this huge impact on security that these government officials are not totally thinking through. And if they get their way, we're going to see a really bad future 5 years from now. It's going to be that, you know, in Back to the Future 2, where Doc Brown draws that skewed future that they end up in. That's where we're on our way to.
Good sci-fi segue.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that cheery note, let's go to some of your questions. Not on.
It's a perennial problem with the
thing. I love that there's a hidden microphone.
Hello?
Nope.
There we go.
Hi. When trying to, you know, petition for governments to adopt better policies, how much effort is made to argue the economic importance of encryption?
I mean, the short answer is a lot. There have definitely been people who've been pointing out that encryption is necessary for things like electronic commerce, like protecting against identity theft. There are many things that encryption protects you from. This hasn't been, I don't think, particularly persuasive to the governments, in the sense that they will tell a story about we're not going to disturb, but we want strong encryption. We just want a key to it. It's they'll say both these things they want at the same time.
Right. So, you know, I want to point out that I'm going to disagree. I never disagree with you, but I'm going to disagree slightly, which is that, you know, it was when the economic argument started getting primacy that we kind of won crypto war one. So that was ultimately the winning argument. It was, you know, the civil liberties community and the technical community were the first people upset about the crypto restrictions, but it wasn't really until industry got behind the argument and said, look, you're hurting the ability of the American economy to grow, that really got the attention of the White House. So, I don't want to dismiss that argument, but now to agree with you, what they're doing is kind of conceding that point and diverging from reality. And the reality is that, yes, encryption is important, and what they want is encryption with a backdoor that only the good guys can get access to. The reality, though, is that encryption that only the good guys can get access to is not actually something we know how to do securely. Basic end-to-end encryption, there are ways to get it wrong, but it's a relatively simple problem. A system that includes some sort of backdoor access, and you might not call it a backdoor, you might call it a side door, or you might call it a golden key, and they use lots of words to avoid saying backdoor, but they're all actually backdoors. If you add a backdoor, you need an enormous amount of very heavily trusted code and processes and infrastructure to manage securely the secrets that only get given to law enforcement or the national security with an appropriate court order. We don't know how to build systems of that complexity that don't fail. Example, all of the data breaches that we see kind of literally every day. You know, the OPM breach where everybody with a security clearance had their records breached probably in the hands of a U.S. adversary at this point. That was a pretty heavily protected database that required access to it far less often than the number of wiretaps that there are every day in the United States. So, you know, protecting a database of the encryption keys for every encrypted communication or stored data that might come to the attention of law enforcement, that's a pretty complex problem. And, you know, an analogy that I've heard said was, well, you know, surely the technical community can do that. I mean, if we can put a man on the moon, surely we can do that. But this is sort of like saying, if we can put a man on the moon, surely we can put a man on the sun, right? This can't be that much harder. Right?
Just a few things for you all to take with you. We have an open letter at securetheinternet.org that you guys can all sign and share, and the economic argument is a part of that open letter to the governments all over the world, and we try to push that point. And to attach one more economic argument to the ones that Kurt mentioned is the fact that we're seeing these challenges to encryption pop up in countries all over the world, but there are always going to be countries that don't have limitations on encryption, which means companies will always have a place to go and offer strong encryption. So countries are incentivizing companies to leave their borders to be secure, which means they are actually not doing themselves a favor economically by putting in place backdoor restrictions on encryption, because then why would a company stay in that country if they know they're going to have to implement an insecure product? So there's an additional economic incentive to not have these backdoors, which is just to have companies be incentivized to come and stay in your border and presumably pay taxes and contribute to the economy.
Okay, right. You mentioned earlier about WhatsApp and about five different countries, many of which I go to and use WhatsApp. So what is my risk in the past and the future going to these countries using basically an encryption app?
One of the things that sort of right now, as far as we know, that there is no backdoor into the WhatsApp protocol. And so what that means is if those other countries want to know what you have said, that they can't get it by just, you know, sniffing the wires and seeing it, because they'll just get encrypted traffic. And then they can then go to WhatsApp, Facebook, through the MLAT process to try to get more information. But probably all they will get is metadata, which can be actually extremely powerful and you know, will be invasive of your privacy. At least as far as we know, there is no backdoor in the WhatsApp protocol. And I would hope that if the IPA was in fact invoked against Facebook, that they would fight it pretty hard, and we'll see how that goes.
If you're worried about your metadata, Signal offers a very similar product to WhatsApp, but with much less data retention of your metadata, so you're less likely to be able to have a government go to Signal as a company and have records that they could even turn over, if that is a worry.
And I want to add one other thing is that for a company like Signal, it's an open source product. It is based in the United States as a nonprofit. And so if you know Kazakhstan asked Signal to comply with their law, Signal's in a pretty good position to say no. They'll have to cross Kazakhstan off the list of countries that they can later go visit, but otherwise it's going to be hard for Kazakhstan to enforce that. But I think it gets much more challenging for commercial companies like Facebook, who have boots on the ground all over the world, and especially in China, where there's a strong incentive to reach that market. But open source projects are at least more resistant to these kinds of pressure than others.
So, that said, look, put yourself in the position of whoever it is that's trying to get to your communication. Somebody working for a well-funded, nation-state level organization like the FBI or the equivalent of the FBI in China or Russia or so on, with with vast resources. If the communications channel dries up and you're an interesting enough target, what they're going to do is try to compromise your phone or the phone of the person that you're communicating with by exploiting some of the many vulnerabilities that exist in literally every platform and app and so on, because, see my earlier comments, we are incompetent at avoiding putting those vulnerabilities in, even with the best intentions. So I'm pretty good at this stuff, and I'm absolutely confident that if a government agency were trying to target my device, that they would succeed. I think that's not a realistic thing to try to defend against. What encryption does is forces them to do that if that's what they want to achieve. So I think the concern that we'd have with something like WhatsApp or Signal or so on is probably not going to be that they're going to pressure the vendor to to backdoor the product itself, though they certainly want to do that. But in the absence of that, that doesn't mean problem solved and your communication is absolutely impenetrable if you're being targeted.
All right, go ahead.
Okay, I was going to ask about the competitive disadvantage of backdoor laws on tech industry in a country. One sort of thing that keeps me up at night is the idea that, say, the U.S. passes a backdoor law, and then there's this flight of the technology sector out of the U.S. to somewhere else that, like I think the Netherlands has an anti-backdoor law. How plausible is that?
Well, it's plausible. It's happened already to a certain extent, because, like with the NSA disclosures, they found out that the NSA was, the government was interdicting products, which was basically, while they're being shipped, going and opening the packages and inserting sort of backdoors. And that was not just a random occurrence, but it was like a regular program within the federal government that did that. And so as a result of that disclosure and a bunch of other ones, a lot of companies and countries wouldn't do business with that, with those companies. And so I don't remember the exact figure, but it was in the billions of dollars, I believe, of business that was lost to U.S. companies because of that. I think China banned any use of American routers, and so stuff like that sort of becomes a race to the bottom almost.
So as the person on the panel who works in D.C., two things. First of all, the chance of an anti-encryption law bill actually passing anytime soon, I would put at pretty low now.
In the U.S.
In the U.S. Right. There is not an appetite for it at all in the House. There are a few senators who are really into it, but the Senate has many, 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 many other priorities that they need to get to that they have not yet gotten to. And so Congress kind of has its hands full with what it needs to do right now, let alone to pick up a bunch of other things. That's not to say it won't happen, but we try to keep an eye on these things, and I would put the chance at pretty low of this passing. That said, when the Snowden revelations occurred, there were a lot of companies that had to leave the U.S. because they took such an image hit from the idea in other countries from people that they were complicit with the U.S. government, that they had to show that, not only were we not, and not only would we fight these things, but we're going to like now leave our like leave the U.S. as our home base and go to Europe or go somewhere else to do business. So even without a law, there is this perception issue that companies deal with when users in other countries think that they're complying with requests that might not be mandated by law, but they might feel like the government can pressure them to do things.
And even if there isn't a law per se, like an actual statute on the books, disclosures that came out revealed that, for example, with Yahoo and Google, their servers were being, there was encrypted traffic between their, in their cloud essentially, but then outside of the borders of the United States, the government would go in and basically tap outside of the borders. So, you know, as a practical matter, I don't know how much a law on the books would actually help that situation. And then when that was revealed, it was would have the same effect as if there was a law mandating a back door. So.
All right, next question, please.
Hi. I was wondering, you know, everybody always talks about how we're always fighting the last war, and I'm curious about what you guys see in the future on the horizon here with technology always changing faster than policy does. Do you think there's anything, you know, in its infancy currently that will come to be, you know, maybe render some of these policy points obsolete or change the conversation quite a bit? Things like artificial intelligence, quantum computing, whatever. You know, are any of these developments going to radically change the way that we're looking at this struggle currently?
So I think the, you know, as a technologist, I think the, I think we're in kind of a race. Right now, we've integrated strong encryption into some fraction of the fabric of the internet and of apps and so on, in ways that will be hard to reverse where they exist, where they're put in. And, you know, right now in the United States, and the United States probably still dominates the design of technology. There's no, of the relevant technologies, there are no laws preventing you from using the strongest encryption you can design and put in. And to the extent that, you know, we can accelerate that process in industry and in the open source community and in the technical standards community and so on, you know, before, you know, bad rules get put into place in the U.S. and around the world, you know, that makes a lot of the discussion, you know, it tips the balance of a lot of the discussion in favor of having these protocols there. It's much harder to roll back something that exists than to stop you from putting something in the first place. So I think that's the sort of brightest hope that we have for technology making the argument irrelevant, but it's you know, laws will still be powerful, and that's always going to be something we'll have to pay attention to. But we get the upper hand when there's an existing system out there that encrypts things strongly.
Hi, thank you for doing this panel.
A little closer
today.
To the mic.
Thank you for doing this panel today. I have a pretty good idea of, you know, what we don't want or what we're against, but I'd be interested from each of the panelists, if you were to, you know, able to advocate, or for that matter, wave a wand and say, okay, this is what you want, what would be the one or two things that you say, yeah, this is what I would really, the direction I would want us to go in, or this is the direction I would tell policymakers that this is where you would want to go?
I would have wanted President Obama to actually respond to the petition that reached the petition threshold that EFF and ExcessNow led last year, in response to saying definitively that the White House supports strong encryption. Even though the administration has changed, having a statement from the White House would have been an incredibly strong indicator of where the U.S. conversation was going and would have sent a message globally. Like I said, there is political cover being used, and that could have switched the global conversation. I also want the Congress and the FBI to take up the fact that we don't have a hacking law in the United States, and the FBI thinks that it can hack under existing authority. And I think while that is tangential to the crypto conversation, I think it is increasingly relevant, increasingly dangerous what they're doing, and that would be right underneath that statement on my wish list.
So I'm going to disagree with Amy, which I never do, that it's tangential to the crypto argument, and I'm going to say that that's central to the crypto argument. I think the my ask would be to recognize that strong encryption without making it cumbersome with backdoors and making it weak with backdoors is a critical issue for the security of the global economy and security of the entire world, and just allow that to happen. Now, what's going to happen if you get what you want? Well, what will happen is that law enforcement and national security agencies are going to accelerate the use of targeted attacks of vulnerabilities on platforms and endpoints like phones and computers. And that's, it's already happening today. The FBI has a significant capability to do this when wiretap-based surveillance fails. So, they're doing this today, but it's largely unsettled law about what the rules are for it. Is hacking into your phone to get your communications covered under the very strong laws for that require a wiretap super warrant? Well, probably, but there aren't really any cases on this. What about the increasing role of metadata? Metadata, increasing amounts of metadata are being collected. That's going to be increasingly exploited by law enforcement investigators. What are the rules around that? Well, those rules currently date back to the old telephone network, and when the only metadata was who you were calling on your landline phone. Now, that includes the location of your cell phone when you're making calls. Largely unsettled law on that. So, what are the rules for hacking into using existing vulnerabilities? What are the rules for exploiting metadata? That's a conversation that we urgently need to have sooner rather than later.
You just made me think of a bunch of things. If I had a magic wand. A couple things. The FISA court, I think that their use of granting general warrants for thousands of IP addresses over a year or however you want to, whatever their language is, if we could eliminate that, I could wave a wand and eliminate that, that would be great. Also, the idea that collecting the information is somehow not invasive of someone's privacy. The government has often made the argument that collecting it isn't a search under the Constitution. I think if we could all agree, or if I could wave the wand and everybody agreed that collecting is just as bad as actually querying it, I think that will go a long way to eliminate the abuse that we see. Also, knowing exactly what is being collected, even that seems to be a struggle. There's huge data centers. I think there's one in Colorado. I don't know if it's finished now, but that's a perennial example of these huge data centers are being built, and I don't know what's going into them. Their budgets oftentimes are not disclosed to the public. So if we just had transparency, setting my values aside, at least we would have the information to make an informed decision. But right now, I don't think we have that information, so we can't make a decision on it. Matt mentioned, Amy mentioned a hacking law. I think that another option might be to impose some liability on companies when they don't enforce when they don't protect users' data. That's sort of a tricky concept, but I think if we gave them an incentive to protect users' data. As of right now, they don't have much of incentive to do it if there's a breach or something.
One thing I would really like to see is for law enforcement, intelligence community figures to adopt a new mindset of how can we exist in a world in which there is ubiquitous strong encryption and in which you have to go to a court and prove up your case before you can breach the data, that breach the walls protecting the data and get at it. There's a lot of efforts from that side of the fence to try to push back that possible world and be at one in which their access is the easiest. And as Matt was mentioning in our last panel, that is the role of law enforcement to try to make it as easy as possible for them. But it might also be useful to think about how we can live in a world in which, you know, everything is being encrypted all of the time, and can you still function? I can point out, you know, if we look back into the past, we've had things. For a while, there were these things called public telephones, like on the street. There would be just a phone you could pick up and make a call. And they were fairly anonymous. You'd have to actually be surveilling one to see who went inside. The people could make a call that was more or less untraceable back to them. And, you know, society survived and was able, you know, law enforcement was able to conduct their business, even though it was possible for just anybody to make an anonymous phone call for a few pennies or up to, you know, 25 cents towards the end of it. There was a time in history in which there was, for about 70 years, an unpickable lock, and so you could have a safe and put things in it, and no one could pick the lock. And this was before dynamite, and so you couldn't really blow your way into the lock. If you tried to get in by melting it, you'd destroy the stuff inside. So you did have a time when there were things that were simply out of the reach of law enforcement, and society nevertheless, you know, continued on. So it would be nice to have a new policy discussion in which we recognized the tremendous values of encryption for safety and security, tried to see how we can also have our interest in preventing and stopping crime and work within that system. All right, shall we have the next question?
Hi, I was wondering if you could each comment kind of on the wish list idea about what might be useful, apart from more transparency, because I know that's just a given, on the vulnerability equities review process. What would be something, a gesture of good faith that the government could do that would satisfy privacy advocates like yourself?
Well, I think that one thing they could do to make a showing of good faith would be to provide more protections for email that's stored on a company's servers. And Kurt might be able to go into more detail about that, but I believe if it's on the server for 60 or 90 days, it's not considered private anymore. You don't have an expectation of privacy about it.
I think what Blair's talking about is the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And there's an effort to reform that act to require warrants. So I think your question was more about the Vulnerabilities Equities Process, or the VEP, which is a policy that ostensibly the government has, where if they find a vulnerability in a piece of software, hardware, et cetera, that they will consider the equities, balance out, well, if we report it to the vendor so the vendor can fix it, that will make people more secure, but we might also want to exploit it in order to fulfill our intelligence or law enforcement missions, balance out these issues, and then decide to disclose or not disclose. And we have a little bit of information about that. We have a written.
Thanks, EFF.
Yeah, so my organization, my colleague, Andrew Crocker, did a Freedom of Information Act request that got a redacted version of that policy made public. So we've got to see a little bit of information about it. But we don't have very many sort of real-world examples of how it's been used. I've heard a spokesman for the NSA claim that 90% of vulnerabilities are disclosed to the vendors, but I know people who work at a lot of very prominent companies that would be vendors in this context, and they have not heard of vulnerability coming through those channels. It is possible that that was used in the internal blue, the leaked NSA tool that eventually led to the WannaCry ransomware attack, was disclosed to Microsoft perhaps a long time after it had been leaked, but slightly before it had been weaponized. But we don't have much transparency and into that process. And one other sort of challenge with this was what happened in the Apple iPhone case, which was that the government purchased an exploit, a black box exploit, without purchasing the vulnerability. And so in their view, they did not have to go through the equities process. They just got into the phone and they said, well, we're contractually obligated just to use it for this one exploit, or, you know, for this one phone. We can't tell Apple what the vulnerability is. And we don't need to go through the VEP. But think of.
So, you know, first of all, you've asked the hardest question, right? The whole VEP thing is really, really complex, and we don't actually have great answers to what, you know, if you ask me to design a good VEP program, there's a whole bunch of stuff that I wouldn't actually know how to do. How do they actually make their decisions, right? So the vulnerabilities equities process is basically intended, a vulnerability is either discovered by or comes to the attention of the U.S. government, whether law enforcement or intelligence agencies. They have to make a decision, do we hold on to this and exploit it quietly, or do we report it to the vendor so it will get fixed? If they report it to the vendor, there's going to be some amount of time that it takes the vendor to develop a patch and deploy that patch. So you know, when we talk about reporting it, the decision to report doesn't mean it can never be exploited by the government. It means that they're essentially setting a clock where at some point this vulnerability will stop being useful for exploitation. So the question that they have to ask themselves is, at what point does the risk of independent rediscovery of this vulnerability exceed the risk that something bad will happen that could have been prevented by the government exploiting it against an adversary from their perspective, if you grant them that the work they're doing is legitimate? I don't actually know how to perform that calculation, because it's based on, you know, something you can't possibly know. So now you're going to have to look at things like, well, how broad a platform is this? How widely used is this? Is this an encryption system that's used exclusively by ISIS? Well, I think we all probably agree, no need to report that to ISIS. But on the other hand, if it's a vulnerability in the iPhone that allows anyone to get remote access to it, we probably all agree, that sounds pretty dangerous. We really don't want that being exploited by others. That needs to get fixed really soon. So, you know, I think one of the things that we need, and as a computer science researcher in security, I'm speaking a little bit out of self-interest here, is we need a lot more research into the nature of vulnerabilities to get kind of good models of how dangerous is this vulnerability, in ways that can really be make a convincing case and allow them to apply some calculus that gives some real confidence that says, hey, this one really does need to be reported. And right now, we just don't have the tools to do that.
The only thing I would add is there's been a law introduced to codify the vulnerabilities equities process and ensure that it goes on, because it actually existed for a really long time and wasn't used. And then they, quote unquote, reinvigorated it after the Heartbleed attack. I think that codification would be a good step, and the government could support that codification, even if, as I said earlier, Congress is probably not going to pass a lot of things right now. Their support of and actually like investing in and contributing to the process of drafting that law, I think, would be really valuable, and that would be a great show of good faith if they came to the table there.
All right, I think we're more or less out of time. So thank you, everybody, for coming, and really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kurt.